I don't think that we will ever be in a position where everyone is working together again. I think that going forward, we are always going to have a hybrid model, and we should. I think that it's really more about how do you work most effectively and what's going to be best for you. Maybe it's going in the office 3 times a week, staying home 2 times a week. Like, maybe it's having the ability, if your role allows it, to work in Thailand for 6 months of the year. Like, who knows? I think that the point is that we will never be in a position where everyone is in the office all the time at the same time again. I think it is going to be a hybrid model, and it should.
Hello, and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello, and welcome to episode 25 of the podcast. In this podcast, we are joined by Celine Williams, who is an executive and team coach based in Toronto, Canada. Celine is the founder of the coaching consultancy Revisionary, which you can check out at revisionary.ca. Now, Celine is quite well known in Canada, and she does a lot of speaking at events with leaders. And we've been chatting for a while about what we'd get Celine on the podcast to talk about. And we've kind of spent a bit of time getting to know each other and thinking about what would be a good topic to cover. And John and I were chatting around what's something that leaders are really, you know, grappling with at the minute, and what's kind of an upcoming trend that's here to stay. And obviously there's only one answer to that, and that is working remotely. So when we thought about working remotely and what are the skills, preparation, and things that leaders need to consider when thinking about working remotely in a more permanent or hybrid way, we thought, well, let's look to the US and Canada and businesses that have operated remotely for a long time. And Celine was a natural choice to have a speaker to come on and talk in depth on this subject. Celine's early career, she spent 11 years working remotely, working for an organisation that worked across the US and Canada, and she's since specialised and works with leaders across the US and Canada on a remote and face-to-face basis. And what really excites me about talking to Celine is a concept she's come up with around the need to have even more emotional intelligence when you're working remotely than you would do face-to-face. And this is something that she's labelled remotional intelligence. And we've invited her on the podcast today to really talk about the concept of emotional intelligence and how it fits in with the notion of team coaching. So a very different take on coaching today, more on that team dynamic, and how there's never been a time where it is more important to think about how you are investing in how your team work together, how you are supporting them to work together as a team, and how you can think about working and leading remotely in new and different ways. Just a note on this conversation, we recorded this conversation on New Year's Eve. It was really, really a really, really wonderful way to end the year. But given we're making it live at the end of January, when we talk about this year and next year, we are, of course, talking about this year being 2020 and next year being 2021. When I know you are listening to it in 2021. It was such a gift to be able to record this with Celine remotely on New Year's Eve. John and I had our little Christmas party, a remote Zoom glass of wine after doing this. And we really did leave this conversation buzzing and really excited for what team coaching could bring. We as coaches really took a lot out of this conversation with Celine, and myself as a leader working with other teams remotely took a hell of a lot out of this conversation. It's a goodie. Enjoy.
Hi there. Welcome to Building Better Leaders. Today we're absolutely delighted to be joined by Celine Williams. Celine is an executive and team coach. She helps purpose-driven and people-focused leaders and companies navigate change, up their EQ, and improve performance. Based in Toronto, Canada, her company is Revisionary. Hey, Celine, welcome to the show. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here and have this conversation. So I run a boutique consulting firm, as you said, and I do mainly My team, we do mainly executive and team coaching, but I also specialize in designing culture. I believe that culture in organizations and teams can be by design or by default, and it makes much more sense to design it than to let it happen by default. And then leadership development. I always joke for the 21st century workplace because it's very much not the I don't think about leadership development in the traditional ways. I don't think it has to be these massive systems. I think there's really simple, easy things that we can do that are not performance, annual performance management, that is actual real leadership development and ongoing feedback. So I'm a firm believer in design thinking and continuous feedback and continuous improvement. And I sort of work that into all of the work that I do. But that's kind of what I do and what my business does. And then, otherwise I merely am based in Toronto, where it's quite cold these days, the joy of winter.
Go on, let us know. How cold is it?
I mean, it rained yesterday, which meant it was about 3 degrees Celsius, which is hilarious that that's rain. And today it's probably about -4 or -5, and we're at the start of winter, so it's going to get colder.
Yeah. I've only been to Canada once because I do have my uncle lived there for the majority of his life, and but I was fortunate enough to go in the summer, so it was very nice then. It is two extremes, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it's so funny. So my parents are both immigrants. My dad's from the UK, and one thing that he said is like that he loved about Canada. He actually never went back to. He didn't go back to England for the last, like, I don't know, 40 years of his life or something.
Really?
Because he was like, he actually really enjoyed the four seasons. We have four in Toronto, at least, not all of Canada. We have four distinct seasons. We have a hot summer where it's like 28 to 35 degrees Celsius all summer. And then we have a cold winter where it's like, zero to minus things that are way too cold. And then we have the spring and fall where it's in between, and spring is really damp and fall is really dry. It's just, we have these beautiful seasons, which is, I don't love winter, full disclosure. I also don't love the really hot in summer, but like the four seasons is a wonderful way to map a year in your brain and to see the transitions. And, we were talking about change as part of what I do. When you can see the change happening around you in the seasons, when you can experience what that's like, you can mark the passage of time in a very different way. So it's actually really lovely to have the seasons that we have, even though they can be a bit extreme.
Yeah, I really like that idea about the them being very, very distinct, and you do sort of merge into these changes, don't you, across the four seasons. Celine, what's your, as we're talking about 2020 there, what would you say your highs and lows were for 2020? Because we've had this terrible thing with COVID and lots of people have been really negative. And we do that as human beings, don't we? We talk a lot in the negative. What have your highs and lows been for 2020?
Well, I think like everyone, the lows have been COVID. I mean, just that. But, as part of that, not traveling. I don't have family in Canada. So despite the fact that I grew up here, my parents are both dead. And so they immigrated here as adults separately from two different countries. I don't have family here. So I have not seen my aunts and my cousins and the people that I'm close to. So not traveling has been a big low for 2020. I'm very excited for that to change at some point soon. Mm-hmm. I would say there's been a lot of isolation, right? Like as much as I don't have kids, I don't have a big family. So I have wonderful cats and I have a wonderful partner, and there's, lots of, but it's more isolating than I would normally. It's been more isolating, and that's been a low because that can be very challenging and has been very challenging personally, as well as for the people. I mean, I don't know anyone who hasn't felt some version of that this year in some way. I think that I look around at all of the businesses and all of the things that have had to close and have been affected. I have a gym membership to a very small gym, and the owner that's, women run, focuses just on having women in the gym, and she's really struggled this year. And I look at things like that, and that's heartbreaking because these are small businesses in my community that I want to support and I wish we could do something for, and they're just being forced, they can't open. She's being forced to not open. So a lot, I think those have been some of the real lows, is watching that happen and then watching the response of, or lack thereof, or differing response, or whatever you want to call it, of the authorities and the people in charge of this, that has been very frustrating. It's been very frustrating to watch what feels like a not consistent or really well thought out response to something, and not future focused. It has felt very reactive as a year, right? Very overall. And that is, that's very frustrating. My brain is wired in such a way where as soon as we react, because we have to, no one planned for the pandemic. No one was like, hey, here's this thing that's going to come. What are you going to do about it? We reacted fine. The way we reacted in March, the lockdowns, what we did, fine. How is it possible my brain goes, how is it possible that 8 months later, we're doing the exact same thing? There's no better plan in place. That is a big low for me, because it's so frustrating. And it's also been a really wonderful year in certain ways. So I will say that on a global perspective, the amount of care and the amount of thought and the amount of wonderful examples of humanity that have happened this year, I think have been incredible. The frontline workers, the doctors and nurses who at the beginning were risking their lives when there weren't enough masks, there weren't enough anything, but they're so committed to taking care of people, they were risking their own lives, I think is a beautiful example of the human spirit and how when the chips are down, people come together. I think that the global conversation around, well, I say global, but I am in North America, so it's definitely in North America, and I have seen examples of it around the world, around the realities of racism and bias, and the fact that it is now a conversation this year, more so than it has been in a very long time, I think is extraordinarily important. And I am so heartened to see the conversation changing, because it hasn't for a long time. And then for me personally, I've done the most fun work I've ever done in my life this year. I have changed my business in ways that I had, you know, leaders ask me to do certain things. And I thought, oh, I mean, that sounds great. I'd love to try it. And they let me experiment and play this year. And that's been extraordinarily fun and unexpected. I've got to read more books this year, weirdly enough, just by not traveling, than I thought I would. So it's been, I spent lots of time with my cats. That has been lovely. So there's been like truly some real joyful moments and happiness inside of this as well. And 2020 was a really interesting year for that perspective, right? There were some real, really large and sort of overwhelmingly negative things globally and individually. And then also some really wonderful things globally and individually.
Yeah. I definitely echo that. I mean, I think this has been the year that's really taught us that you can hold two emotions simultaneously. Like, how can you be so happy in one moment and yet so frustrated at the same time? One's about being with your family and one's about the government of the authorities. And I certainly have got very used to been more aware of my emotions and more aware of, you know, I think when you're brought up, it's quite black and white, your emotions, you're either sad or you're happy or you're scared. And I think a lot of people have actually started to realize that you can feel a lot of things all together. And that's been, it's very different to what we expect, isn't it?
Well, I think society kind of trains us to think it is an either or situation, right? Whether it's, you know, we feel this or that, this is right or wrong, this is yes or no. Everything is very polarizing as opposed to the reality of life, which is 98% of life is gray. It is not black or white. It is some version of gray. And it's funny because, you know, working with some of the teams that I've worked with this year, the thing that has come up that people have talked about with each other, with their spouses, that they've, you know, then come to me and spoken about, is the biggest difference that they've seen in our conversations is I'm constantly pointing out the gray. So I'm constantly pointing out, like, it's okay to be angry about this situation and hopeful at the same time. It's okay to feel frustrated about something and excited about the possibility. It's okay to be unsure of the future and what's going to be happening and still working towards something with the hopes that it goes whatever, instead of being in this very polarizing space. And it is, this has been the year for everyone, not just this group of people who are consistently and constantly working on living in the gray and being comfortable in the uncomfortable. This has been the year for everyone where we have not had any choice. We have had to get used to the fact that there's a lot of gray and it is not as polarizing black and white, right or wrong, yes or no, as we have been conditioned to think based on how we educate and raise people.
Totally.
I was thinking while you were talking there, Celine, of so many situations that I've come across this year where you're looking at world leaders or your country's leadership, and there are no you talk about the gray, there are no particular areas that you can say yeah, they've done really well here or they've done very badly here, and all you do all the time is keep questioning what's actually happening. And there are so many questions to ask about it, and it's infinitely more complicated than the media would let you believe. And I just wonder, are there any particular leadership sort of traits that you've seen that you think have been really, really good? Are there other lessons that we should be learning from this from a wider perspective?
Well, I love that you asked that question, because I think one of the things that we've seen this year, unfortunately, which is a great lesson for leaders to take, is we've seen a lot of world leaders, whether it's, you know, a state, a province, a country, whatever leadership that they have on a bigger scale, we've seen a lot of them make decisions and then double down on those decisions regardless of the information. So just, they're not sharing information openly. They're not being transparent about what they're learning, and they're just doubling down on something instead of explaining why this is happening. So the explanations they're giving are, minimal, surface, not based in really good, transparent information. And they say, great, I've made this decision. Let me double down. Here's a leadership lesson in that. Stop doing that. Let's be transparent. Let's actually share valuable information. Let's share the thought process and reasoning behind this with really good data, not assumptions, not the biases that we tend to come in with. And when we get better information, the best thing we can do is make a different decision and explain why. It's like people think that if we change our minds based on better information, the world is going to see us as weak. Nobody sees that as weak. People actually see that as a strength. When you can take in new information and go, oh, that was not a great, I didn't make a great decision there. Let me make a better one with this information. And here's why I'm doing that. The fact that so many of these leaders, and I'm making an assumption in saying that my guess is that they're not doing that because they think it's viewed as weak. The fact that they're not doing that is the problem. So wonderful leadership lesson. Let's be transparent. Let's share the information openly. Be open to new information and be open to making a better decision based on that information. Don't just double down on something because we've done it once.
When you talk about that double down in then, Celine, is it that like confirmation bias where, 100%. You know, you go and find, you know, you have an idea about this is what it is in my mind. And therefore I go and find the evidence to support what I was already thinking.
Absolutely.
And not explaining and not sharing all the relevant information that is available, and not looking at cross divided opinions either and saying, well, I have these people over here that think this in this camp. However, there are these people over here who think differently. Now, what can we learn between the two groups?
Yep.
Rather than, no, I quite like these people over here because that suits my narrative.
So that's 100% right. And 100% like that is on the nose. One of the things that, and I don't remember who I was listening to a podcast and it was a thought leader who was talking about the idea of critical thinking. And it was really poignant because the crux of it was, and this is a wonderful lesson that leaders can take from 2020, is that critical thinking should be uncomfortable. If it is not uncomfortable, it's just confirmation bias. You are only looking at the information that already confirms what you are thinking. And most of the leadership we have seen this year has been based in confirmation bias. It has not been, and this is I'm not saying everyone, but we've seen a lot of examples that are based in confirmation bias, not based in the discomfort that comes from actual critical thinking. And part of that is looking at these other points of view. Call them conspiracy theorists. If you don't agree with it, let's be real. In North America, whether you're on the right or the left, you are calling the other side of this the conspiracy theory. They are conspiracy theorists, right? That is just the reality. So call whatever it is a conspiracy theory, call it the other lens on things. You do not have to agree with someone to want to understand them and see the value in something in what they're saying. And you are never going to change hearts or minds, and you are never going to get people on board with things if you do not make the effort to understand them. And the fact that somehow in our brains we equate understanding with agreement is so problematic from a leadership perspective. And it happens all the time. And I hear leaders say, and we have some presidents of countries that would be great examples of this sort of thing, not naming any names. think of whoever comes to mind it's like they go out of their way to completely ignore anything that does not come out of their brain or their mouth. And it just sets a tone and an example that is toxic for real discussion, for real learning, for real understanding. And all you do when you make zero effort to understand another person or side, because you're afraid that saying, oh, I can see your point of view means, oh, I agree with you, is that you turn off and you alienate how many people? For what purpose?
That's... We see exactly the same here, Celine. Not that they're labeled conspiracy theorists, but the right and the left is just this absolute, if I'm right, you have to be wrong.
Yes.
And so all you see in these debates is Keir Starmer, the opposition leader, actually does ask some really interesting questions. But every time he is shot down and mimicked and then told that he's not supporting, that he's against them. And it's like, well, he's asking questions, but you can't actually have a constructive debate with somebody that's totally switched off to it, which unfortunately is what at times Boris Johnson has done here. So we're actually been role modeled the fact this right, one's right, one's wrong, and we have to be in opposition. And yep. Unfortunately that has ramifications across the whole country. And it's just so frustrating.
Well, it's a really great example of, so the idea of having opposition and politics, right? But think of, like, you can take this conversation and apply it to any organization or team, right? Like, we're using politics as the example right now, but it's not limited to politics. The idea of having an opposition party, an opposition group, is actually a brilliant idea from the point of view of, if we think of the opposition as the group that is supposed to point out our biases, that is supposed to point out our blind spots, that is supposed to ask us those questions that we're not thinking of, because we all have blind spots and most of us are blind to our blind spots. So if that opposition is there to help us think critically, they should be the most valuable part of the system that we are working inside of, because that is how we get better. And instead, we have... politics especially, but it happens everywhere. We have created this system where the opposition is wrong. We are just fighting against them. We are not listening to them. We are here to prove them wrong because they are wrong.
And then to cement that, we hire people that think like us, so we become stronger in our version of ourselves and our opinion.
Of course. I mean, it's, no matter what data we're looking at, we can look... I can be this mindset party, whatever you want to call it. You can be a different mindset party, whatever you want to call it. We can look at the same data, raw data, and we can come to two completely different conclusions. And they've done the most fascinating research on this based on the biases of us looking inside that data for what we want to find. So when we are all just, when we are hiring people who are going to prove our point, when we are hiring, working with people who are just going to tell us what we want to hear, we are not growing. We are not expanding. We are not leaning into the possibilities of whatever it is that we're doing, whether it's politics or organization or leading or whatever. And it is one of the, it's a lack of critical thinking. It's a massive failure point, in my opinion, in what the possibility and potential is.
Yeah. With that in mind, you mentioned before that 2020 has been a good year in that you've worked with some really great clients that have allowed you, well, almost persuaded you, I guess, to change your business model. Do you want to talk through some of the kind of work that you've been doing that kind of underpins this new way of thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. So this year, so I've worked with mostly over the past 5 years, not exclusively, but I've worked with people individually. So I've done a lot of individual coaching. I've done kind of two sort of focuses of work. I'm going to give you this context on purpose, so this makes sense. So I've done individual work. So whether it's like individual coaching or sometimes it was a few people in an organization who were on the same team, but I was coaching them individually. And then I've done, like, you know, facilitation for meetings and not necessarily the same groups, right? Quite often not, but facilitation for meetings or trainings or like culture design stuff, which is more organizational than team. And this year has been a really interesting transition. So sort of fall of last year, I had a leader that I work with who, there were a lot of changes in the organization that he is in, including him stepping into the CEO role, which was not, you know, their executive team changed over. He stepped into this new role. He has a, you know, he basically approached me and said, hey, I want you to start sort of working with my leaders, the people that report to me, taking them on over time. By the spring of this year, he's like, I want you to work with all my leaders. I would like to have you working with them one-on-one and then also doing some team stuff with all of us in a very specific way. Would you be interested in that? And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I've never worked with all the leaders individually on a team and then worked with the team as a whole. That's, yeah, 100%, let's do that. So I did that. This is not a me thing. They're doing all the work. I want to be really clear. Like, this is not a Celine is special in any way, shape, or form. The work is incumbent upon them. But the changes that they saw and that the alignment that has come out of it and the conversation changes and the dealing with things in a timely manner has been unparalleled. Their parent company, like their CEO of their parent company, because it's a large global organization, you know, was like, this is incredible. I've never seen a team come together this quickly. And they've been doing this for years, right? He was just like, this is astonishing, the work that's been done. And as a result, I now have people that work on different teams in their organization that's not just at the senior table, you know, that most executive level, working in the same way where it's, you know, a team of six managers, let's say, and they're working with all of the managers and then doing some work as a group as well, because that alignment and that, the changing the conversations, the changing the dealing with difficult topics, the changing how they give feedback, changing how they relate that. It's not true. I like many of the ideas around the first team. I don't love all of them, but
to give this context, that would be looking at the Patrick Lencioni kind of version that the first team that you are a part of is your peer group team. So when we're talking about a leadership team, you're saying you might be the CMO, but your first team is the executive team. And then your marketing team is your second team. Yeah.
Right. Right. And thank you for that. So, yes. Yeah, so I don't love all of everything about that. I think there's some really great concepts inside of it. I don't love all of it, but seeing this alignment at that, let's call it first team level, even at like a manager level, how it trickles down and how it's affected the culture and how it's affected the leadership discussions has been, again, astonishing. You know, this organization, we're literally doing interviews. My team is doing interviews with people in the organization. None of the people we're coaching, none of the people who are involved in this executive or team coaching, other people in the organization. And across the board, what we are hearing is they can see the difference in how people are leading and the effects on the culture in less than a year.
That's amazing.
That must engender more faith in the system then, because once people start to see it, then they're more invested in it, if you like. Were there people in these teams, Celine, did they have some reservations in doing this kind of work?
Yes.
What were they, and sort of how did you manage to get around them?
So the part of the reason this works or worked as a starting point was that the CEO of this organization is the type of leader that people want to follow. And I mean that in the best way. Like, he is an incredible leader. And so when he came up with this idea, because it was him and we had a conversation about it, and it was him being like, I think I want to do this in this way. And I was like, I mean, that sounds really cool. I like the way you think. I like the way you think about it. Let's discuss this and figure out how this would work. So part of the reason it got off the ground was because when he proposed it to his team, there were people who were hesitant, but they trust him so much that they were like, okay, let's give this a try. So the hesitation that was there was different depending on the person. So lots of people did not really know me. It's not, I had not worked with everyone on that team before. And lots of people on the other teams did not know, you know, the people on my team either to be working with. So there was not always trust with me. So, or any coach who was doing this. So some of the hesitation is, how is this going to be confidential? How is this actually, how do we know this is going to be confidential if you are talking to me and you're talking to all of my peers? That was a big concern, right? I would say some of the other stuff that came up was, you know, how do we know this is going to make a difference? How do we know this is going to do anything from a change perspective? Because this is not a process or a system that is like, here's the checkbox that we know when we get the result that we want. This is people and change and, you know, changing conversations and relationship dynamics. That is, I mean, I would love if anyone comes up with a system that is a nice, easy checkbox so we know and it's the way it's supposed to be. That would be great. So much easier to sell that concept than like, just trust me and we'll see alignment. You know, it sounds really kind of out there. And if you are a very process-driven people or very data-driven person, and there are lots of people that I'm working with who are like that, they were like, I mean, are we really going to see any difference from doing it this way?
I'm investing all my time in this, and
exactly.
I can't see cause and effect.
That's right. Yeah. Now when we're there. So there was a lot of that, and among other things. So having the trust that they had in the CEO was how we got this off the ground the way we got it off the ground. And it really, you know, one of the things that I've seen over the course of this year and doing this work is it really has been impressive to watch a leader like this who has this much trust from his people, who has grown trust over the year despite this crazy year, who has grown trust in the organization despite this insanity. And this is, you know, 7,000 person organization. It's not small. All of this has grown because of his commitment to transparency, to, you know, being as open as he can be, to not having to be right all the time or not having to have the answer. And so they trusted him and they were at least open to it. And there is not one of the people who we are working with, whether it's me or one of my team members, so whether it's at the senior executive table or another table, who has not gone out of their way to acknowledge the difference that they have seen in how they are leading, how they are managing the changes that have happened this year, how they are dealing with people at all levels of the organization as a result of having this space to work through some of these things, step into conversations differently, be made aware of some of their blind spots, open up to different points of view. All of this has come as a result of the work that we're doing.
So just to kind of give our listeners and people that perhaps in leadership positions that are thinking, God, this sounds interesting, but what is it that you're talking about? What are the kind of interventions that you did? How, you know, give it to us in a bite-sized form, some of the things that you were doing.
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, one of the biggest ones, okay, so here's the really interesting, I'm going to give this context because I'm going to talk about context. Here's the really interesting thing that I don't think I realized was as important as it has been this year. And I'm a person who's been talking about the importance of context for 5 years nonstop, like that annoying mosquito in your ear that's like, context matters, context matters, context matters. So when I am talking to multiple people about whatever is happening overall at the senior leadership table, in the organization, from the culture perspective, from their whatever it is, I get so much more context than I have when I'm talking to just one person. And this is one of the things that has always frustrated me about coaching, is if I am talking to you, John, or you, Rachel, one-on-one, I am only getting your perspective on something. So I can only work with the things that you bring to the table in that moment.
And the way that we see them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the way that you see them. And when I am talking to you, John, and you, Rachel, and I hear your perspective on the same thing or on the conversation you're going to have or on something that's coming up as an issue, I can ask different questions. It's not that I'm necessarily leading you to my conclusion, but I can ask you different questions or point out blind spots that I'm seeing because I have more context of the overall situation.
I think that's true, though, not only of you as a coach, but I'm thinking about this as the leader as well, because
yes,
leaders have team meetings. Yes, of course they do. But team meetings predominantly are the dissemination of information. And yes, you do get some pushback, but only in that, you only get the discussion in that moment. Whereas most one-on-ones are the really interesting relationship stuff, right? So for you as the leader, it's like, I'm going to have my one-on-one with John and I'm going to understand what's going on in John's home life and John's personal life and John's other relationships at work. But actually doing that even in a group way gives the leader even a different context.
Absolutely.
Obviously, you come at it from a different point of view because coaches are trained to ask the different questions.
Yep.
But surely as the leader seeing that too, that must be mind-blowing.
And that's what I love that you pointed out, because one of the interesting things that, you know, this leader and I have spoken about repeatedly is the difference in the team meetings. So they are team meetings that I attend that he runs that are just like informational, which is good for me from a context perspective. And I've run team meetings that are, you know, much more facilitated to a point, to come to a conclusion, whatever it is. And he said, it's really interesting to watch how people relate and watch the information that comes out and see all that context that I don't always get in a group setting otherwise, right? I don't always see it in that same way. And it is a game changer from a leadership perspective as well. And it allows the leaders to ask better questions, to ask different questions. It's changed, you know, how people relate to each other. So, you know, you asked John sort of what we're working on, what comes up. And it is things like, you know, I'm going to use Brene Brown's language, right? The idea of lumbling. There we go. Just all the sounds out of my mouth at once. The idea of rumbling from Dare to Lead, right? Where you're stepping into a difficult conversation. You're stepping into an uncomfortable space. So I separate, and I believe in separating, I know Brene doesn't do this. Sorry, Brene. I believe in separating feedback from rumbling. I think they're very different in how we approach them is different. So rumbling is about a thing or a project or, you know, it's not a personal, whereas feedback is a personal behavior. And I think that how we approach that conversation, because how we react to it is very different. So if there's a piece of feedback that needs to be given, if there is a rumble that needs to happen over a different conversation, they have the space and time inside of the sessions and the work that we do to talk through that, think through their own biases, think through their own assumptions. The amount of time I spend talking about assumptions and questioning people's assumptions and what they are going in there with so they can change their mindset or change that thought pattern before they go in there so they get a different result is astonishing. And it's in every conversation because we all have it. We all react. We all have these thought patterns and beliefs. And if I have an experience, if I've had an experience of John that has consistently shown me, John, this is not personal. I'm just picking on you for this example.
Okay.
If I've had an example of John that when I go in to talk about our project, our finance project, that every time I go in there, John's defensive in some way, shape or form, because I'm saying his team, he thinks I'm saying his team's not doing enough, or he thinks whatever it is, right? Your perspective is in reaction to whatever I'm coming forward with. Then I'm going to go into the next meeting assuming that John's going to be defensive, as opposed to questioning what that assumption is, where it's coming from, what I'm doing to potentially doing that, figuring out how to have a conversation that says like, hey, John, you know, I get the sense that from these conversations, generally speaking, we start off kind of rough, right? Like, I feel like maybe I'm being attacking and maybe you're being defensive. So how can we change this dynamic to be more productive, to move this along? Because I don't think that that's a great use of our time. And I want to, you're my partner in this. I want to be able to work with you. You can't have that conversation if you're not questioning and thinking about those things ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And from a like a week or a month, how does this look? Like, how much time are you spending on this? Because you know, I kind of put my leadership hat on and like, this sounds amazing, but how do you get everybody to do this together? Yeah. Like time, diary management, and how much investment is it? Like, how does it look in terms of sessions and meetings over the course of a week and a month?
So I coach people one-on-one coaching. I do every other week. I don't do weekly coaching. I used to. I don't think there's lots of people that swear by it. I just don't think it's the most effective use of time. And then really? I find that, you know, even in, I find that often, even in fast-moving organizations where things change week by week, no one has had a chance to actually process anything that you discuss in a week. Okay. So it feels like it's just, I'm so fascinated when, and I'm always curious when coaches, anyone is still doing that, the weekly format and really finding success, because I haven't found it to work. It doesn't mean it doesn't work. I just haven't found it to work with the leaders that I work with. So any one-on-ones are bi-weekly. It's an hour at a time. People can reach out. Most people don't. I always say like, it's funny. Like you can reach out in between if you have a question. It's very rare that people do. I always find it really interesting when people are worried that like, they're going to take all my time. What leader has so much time on their hands that they're like, oh, let me just email Rachel 18 times this week. That's not real for leaders. That's not real. So it is every other week we do, they have this team in particular, and another company I work with that we're starting to do this. They have a set sort of group meeting once a week that I attend. And then my team does this with the teams that they're working with as well. Almost all of them have like a group meeting once a week, and we attend for part or all, you know, depending on the meeting. That is when the whole team is together. And so that is where two things happen. One, I get to observe the dynamics of that team and see how things have shifted from an observation standpoint and a context gathering standpoint. It's very valuable for me. And also that's where I have had the opportunity to really facilitate parts of it and facilitate conversations as I'm seeing things come up. So as an example, at one point in the year, there was a lot of tension that was happening. And this is, you know, everyone's gone remote this year. So even the people who were working in the same office at a certain point in time were not working in the same office by the end of this year, you know, by parts of this year. So there's challenges in the teams that were not remote are now remote. The people who were always remote are now even more remote because they're not flying in to see anyone. So now they're, you know, much more isolated. They have new leaders on the team who have never met in person because they've they've been moved into these roles during this pandemic, or things have shifted, teammates have moved around. So all of these things are happening. And so at a certain point in the year, there was all of this tension that wasn't being discussed or wasn't being dealt with. It was, there are other more important things, but it was affecting the overall dynamic of the group and the alignment. And it was affecting how they were leading the people under them, because they weren't dealing with it. It was just kind of, if we don't talk about it, it's going to go away. Like this will, it'll just get, it's just a result of 2020. So, you know, in a situation like that, when I was seeing that trend happening over a couple of weeks, at one of their, you know, weekly calls, I got an hour of time to actually facilitate that discussion and get people to talk about. And again, because their CEO is as vulnerable and open as he is, he started this to get people to really talk about what was going on and deal with it. And it diffused the situation, and it had a ripple effect of them having more one-on-one conversations with each other about what was really going on. And the tension dissipated over the next couple of weeks, because it wasn't just sitting in the background, continuing to grow slowly. It was dealt with head on, and conversations were had, and solutions were come together, and things were moved forward that needed to move forward, and rumbles were had, and feedback was given. And then lo and behold, the tension is gone.
I think that's quite interesting. You say you were there to observe and facilitate that, because in my corporate career, with anybody that's worked in the corporate world will have seen this, and they'll be very familiar with, you can just feel the tension. But to call it out as a member of the team, is you're going to be labeled the troublemaker, or it's going to have some kind of view on it. Whereas having a facilitator that's able to say, oh, I'm sensing this, or could we discuss this? It creates a safer environment where you're not asking anybody to call it out.
Yeah. And that's a really important point in what you're saying, is that it is hard when you are the naysayer on the team. It is hard when you are the person who's playing, quote, devil's advocate all the time. Yeah. It is hard to step into that role, because anyone who is not seeing it your way is going to, is going to get defensive, is going to be like, oh, that Rachel, she's talking about that stuff, right? Like,
this was a role I played often, but that makes you then vulnerable in a time where redundancies are high. You become the one that it would be easier if you weren't there anymore.
That's right. And so it is a lot, you know, my role, and anyone who is thinking of doing this or bringing someone in to do this, their role is to be that observer and to see the trends. And so I'm constantly looking for the trends in what is happening. And I have conversations with the CEO, the leader of this team, around what I'm seeing without ever naming people specifically. It's not like I'm like, you know, I think John's getting really burnt out. But if I see that John and Rachel are both struggling with, you know, stress or pressure, whatever the case may be, I will say, listen, I think you have some people on your team. There's definitely some potential burnout happening, some overwork happening, some overburdening, whether it's that they don't have enough resources, but there's some stuff happening across a number of people that we might need to keep an eye out for, right? Because that can then turn into tension or other things. And then when we see it coming out as a bigger trend, whatever it is, then I get to be the one to start the conversation. So it's not incumbent on anyone else to get uncomfortable and have that label on them, because it does make life much harder as part of a team when you are that person.
How regularly would you have contact then with the CEO, Celine? Because, and I'm sort of curious to know what does he spend most of his time actually doing? What does he see as his role? For sure, it's a functional role because he's CEO, but the organization that you're describing, I would call, and I don't know whether I'm right here, but I would call it a learning organization. The way that you set this up with the CEO was around being curious as to how well this would work from a team basis and a one-to-one in tandem. So I'm just curious, what does he spend most of his time doing? What are his behaviors? Because clearly his people trust him, which allows him that platform, if you like.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to, in my brain, sometimes I think that he, you know, sits around smoking cigars and just hanging out in his fancy office. I don't think that's real. So he is part of the reason that this works, and part of the reason that when you say learning organization, you're right. He is one of those people who is very committed and focused on growth and being better. He's one of very few leaders I have experienced, worked with, or seen, like not even just having worked with, who at his level is constantly seeking feedback all the time. Not waiting for people to come to him, but actually going out and saying, you know, here's this, I've just run this group meeting. What did you think about this? Did this land for you? Like, how, I want real feedback. What can I do better next time? Right? Not just what did I do well, which is what you get a lot at that level. It's what can I do better next time? Cool. I appreciate it. I'm really glad that you like my enthusiasm, but like, what would make this better for you next time? What is the key thing? So he is someone who's constantly seeking that out. So I have calls with him. So challenging point is that I'm working on a few different things within his organization around culture as well. So I talk to him every week, not necessarily about his team, but I do talk to him every week because of the culture work that we're doing and putting in his designing inside of his organization. But we spend probably every other week really focusing on stuff with his team and stuff that he's working through. And so the work that he's doing is, how can he lead his team better? How can he do more work to meet them where they are and understand them better? Part of the reason that the work that I've done, that he has said, I don't make this assumption, that he has said the work that I've done has been so valuable, is helping him understand them quicker, helping him get to the point of getting past whatever his story is much faster, which then actually saves him lots of time because he still has one-on-ones with everyone. He is still doing all of that work as well, but he gets to where he wants to be and he gets them where he wants to be that much faster because it's not only him. And he is not the person who has to solve all the problems anymore. Right. I think one of the things that happens quite often when you are in that leadership role is that everyone comes to you for, you're like the dad or mom of the, you're the parent of the organization. Everyone comes to you for the solution. Everyone, even if it's, I'm not getting along with this person and I don't agree with what they're doing, you know who you know what you do? You run to your mom and dad. So instead of that happening, they have another place to have the conversation, to work out what the tension is, can then go to him with a solution or with the proposal of whatever it is. They get to the result much faster. So he's still doing all of the one-on-ones and he's still doing all that, but the quality of conversation is different because of the work that I'm doing with them and the work that I'm doing with him.
I think just to circle back on what we were talking about earlier about politics, you've just described a real life person who is using the true notion of an opposition at its fullest. Like, he's never going to see anybody criticize him because he's seeing every piece of oppositional information he's been given as true feedback, an opportunity to learn, to better understand, and to understand that his story and narrative is constantly changing and everything is gray. Yep. So it's kind of like what you've just explained circles that back really nicely, I think, for our listeners.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I love it. And it's funny because he would tell you this, that it makes him very uncomfortable how often I push him into the gray. So as much as he seeks feedback, and he does constantly, he also, like all of us, has very specific ways of thinking of things. And mm-hmm. he will, you know, make declarative statements and this is the way it is. And I will constantly be like, you know, it can be both of those things. It can be this and that. And he's like, always with the gray, but it helps him be a better leader because it gets him out of that, you know, that talk track or that neural pathway that says, this is the thing.
Yeah.
It pulls you out of that.
Totally. But you have to have somebody hold you in that space because
yes,
John and I have this discussion all the time, you know, even knowing what we know and knowing the theory, and we do tell a lot of people that we coach all the time, you know, feedback is really underrated and organizations don't approach it with the due diligence that it is needed and that it's super valuable. But so many people go into a feedback situation without preparing themselves for it. And I will do it too. I'll say to people, you know, oh, have you listened to the podcast and what do you think? And then I'll just be expecting like, oh yeah, it was great. And then when somebody actually gives me valuable like feedback or criticism of it, I'll be like, oh goodness, I'm not ready for this yet. And I have to, you know, you really do have to think about what mental place you're in before you go into a feedback conversation. And I think sometimes we don't give ourselves enough preparation space for that. And even knowing that you know it's super valuable, you've still got to constantly remind yourself that you need to stay in that mindset.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm assuming you have read or have heard of the book, Thanks for the Feedback.
Yes.
So there's a lot of wonderful points of that book, but one of the most powerful points is, and the, you know, it's their subtitle, I don't remember the exact subtitle of the book, but is that the problem with feedback is how we receive it.
Yeah.
It's not how we give it, it's how we receive it. And I've run workshops on giving and receiving feedback, and people get really frustrated because I spend so much time on how we receive feedback. And I'm like, it doesn't make a difference. You can give feedback. There's 1,000 ways you can give feedback, not the sandwich method, because that's garbage. There's 1,000 ways you can give feedback that are going to land if the person is open and in the right space to receive the feedback. If they're not, it does not make a difference how you go in there. It's never going to work. It's never going to land for them. And it is so important that we have to be prepared to receive feedback. We have to be open to it. We have to understand the stories we have around it, understand there's nuance inside of it that is vital, because we cannot grow without feedback, full stop.
I just want to jump in on that as well. I hadn't thought about it this way, but even, you know, I'm just thinking about this as a takeaway for me. When we're coaching leaders and when we're doing leadership training, we focus on giving feedback, i.e. a leader's role is to give feedback. But if leaders aren't constantly receiving feedback, actually you're not even role modeling the right thing. So perhaps you've even got me thinking now, we need to change our leadership approach to start with receiving feedback first, because then you're role modeling that it's safe to receive feedback. And then as a leader, you can maybe start to think about how you give feedback once you are really comfortable receiving feedback yourself. And to that leader that you were just explaining, you were saying he's constantly seeking feedback. So therefore he's role modeling receiving feedback.
Yeah, he's making himself quite vulnerable, isn't he? And that's the value, I think, if you like, that he's demonstrating. And if he demonstrates that and people see good results from that, then potentially they're going to open themselves up to being more vulnerable. And then it is about how you receive it, because so much of it's around intention.
Yeah.
What are people's actual intentions with giving the feedback in the first place? It's usually to try and help. But if you become very defensive over anybody giving you any feedback, then you're absolutely right. It doesn't matter. You could never match the way that that person would receive feedback.
100%.
100%.
Yeah.
Go on, Celine. Go on.
I was just going to say that I think that's it's really important, the modeling of feedback. And in this particular case, I have seen other leaders on his team start to do it as well. And I would say, if for any leader who is listening to this, who is thinking, that's a really great idea, I should start asking for more feedback and modeling that example, the easiest thing you can do is start by talking to people and asking them, what should I continue doing? What should I stop doing? What should I start doing? It is the most basic thing we can do. You can ask that specific question of people. So, because one of the worst things that leaders do is they go, oh, I'm going to ask for some feedback, and go, what feedback do you have for me? What are you, what person on your team is going to be like, oh, let me just open up my list of feedback? That's not real. You're not going to get anything valuable. You're not going to get valuable information. But if you say, hey, what am I doing right now that I should do more of? You know, what am I doing right now that I should stop doing that's not serving you? What should I continue doing? Right? Like they're vague, but they're so much more specific and targeted questions, and you will actually get good information from those things and do not only ask what you should continue doing, you need to ask what you should stop doing and what you should start doing, because that's the real value in seeing your blind spots.
Yeah, absolutely.
We would absolutely echo that, wouldn't we, Rachel? It's something we use as well. Fascinating stuff. So you've had to do this quite remotely then?
All remote.
So yeah. A completely sort of new idea, and you've got to do it remotely. How on earth did you manage to do that so successfully?
Very carefully, is what I would say. I've been talking about working remote. So, you know, I started in my previous life when I was in corporate, I was on a remote team, which we called telecommuting back in the day. I was telecommuting with my teammates 18 years ago now, which was before we had wonderful internet like we have now. Oh, am I so grateful for the ability to be on screen with you and be having this conversation in real time. This is a lovely, lovely, you know, bit of technology that we have these days for working remotely. But I was telecommuting when it was not this, when it was dial-up internet, when it was, you know, phone calls, crappy disconnects, everyone dialing into those horrible phone lines that sometimes sounded good and sometimes did not. And we made it work. And I had wonderful leaders at the time who figured out how to make it work. So I have had the benefit of a lot of years experience of working remotely in various capacities. And so for me personally, this year was more a matter of getting my structures different and my work more organized, because I just wasn't able to travel, right? Like I wasn't able to go down and see people or go places to be in person to run training. So it was more adapting what I was already doing to the systems that I was familiar with from working remotely as long as I had been. I think the biggest challenge was really for people who have never been remote, who were not, you know, not the year-long remote work plan that organizations normally would do, which is here's how we're going to make this team go remote. My bigger challenge was dealing with people who had never worked remotely, never wanted to work remotely, who with 48 hours notice, if that, were now working from home with none of the real setups, with none of the real systems in place, with none of the, you know, with all of the pandemic stress on top of it. Making that work, that was the bigger thing than for me personally, was helping them through that and, you know, having that awareness, because we tend to think whatever our situation is what everyone's situation is, because we're in our own brains, right? Like, hey, I have an office in my house that is just me, that I can close the door to, that is fairly quiet, that I can do my work, that I can hop on calls. Not everyone has an office in their house. Not everyone has the privacy. Lots of people have kids that are homeschooled. There's lots of different. Not everyone has a spouse that can take care of a child. Not everyone. People have sick parents at home. People have, you know, are in a construction zone. But there's 1,000 possibilities. And so I think the biggest challenge, or one of the biggest challenges, was that people were assuming that their situation was everyone's situation. I was talking to an executive who went work from home. They have an office in the city that they're in, and he went working from home. And, you know, I've been coaching him for a number of years, and we were having a conversation. He's like, this is great. I think that I'm just going to have like a work from home policy in general going forward. Again, you know, CEO of a large organization. This is a great idea, different organization. This is a great idea. I think that working from home is going to be a thing. I'm getting so much done. This is wonderful. Great. You know, you are making millions of dollars a year. You have a home that is large, that has a private office, that is, you know, soundproof, that was already set up for you. You have a wife who is taking care of your older children. You don't have little kids at home. They're in their teens, right? They're doing their own thing. Your wife is making sure they're fed and taken care of. You get to go into your office every single morning and sit on your computer and do your phone calls and be super productive and then leave and walk outside and your wife has made you dinner and things. Look at you. I totally appreciate why working from home is such a great idea. Have you talked to anyone else in your organization? Are they having the same experience? Is that receptionist who's now working from home and answering phones, who's 25 years old and has a 3-month-old baby, is she having the same experience that you're having? Probably not. And that was the biggest thing this year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'll be interesting. Can you remember the quite knee-jerk announcements from organizations like Twitter that said they would allow their employees to work from home indefinitely, like forever now? And I think what was really interesting is those announcements, those PR stunts kind of stopped very abruptly after the second wave, like come September. So I'm glad we're on this conversation, because one of the things that really sparked us about you, Celine, was one of your talks that you do on emotional intelligence. Do you want to talk a little bit about what this notion of emotional intelligence is and what leaders need to be really thinking about differently when we're thinking about working remotely indefinitely? And I think 2021 will be a situation where some people may work remotely, some people may not. We may have a blend. But this notion of everybody working together, we could assume is not going to happen for the rest of the year. So what role does emotional intelligence as a leader play in that?
Yeah, so I want to say this, that really more about how do you work most effectively and what's going to be best for you. Maybe it's going in the office 3 times a week, staying home 2 times a week. Like, maybe it's having the ability, if your role allows it, to work in Thailand for 6 months of the year. Like, who knows? I think that the point is that we will never be in a position where everyone is in the office all the time at the same time again. I think it is going to be a hybrid model, and it should, as an employee and then as a consultant and coach. All of the work, not all, most of the work I was doing was on the phone anyways. It wasn't in-person coaching. It was a lot of it was on the phone, and I was like, oh, there's a really interesting element of emotional intelligence when you are working remotely, when you are dealing with people in a remote capacity, because you have none of the information that you get when you're in person. You have none of the nuances. You often don't have, you know, facial expressions. Sometimes on video you do, but like, here's the Zoom is great. Love Zoom. And Zoom is very performative. So we put on our best face when we're on Zoom. We don't have that, you know, we're much more aware of the micro facial expressions that we're making, because it's like being on film, right? So even if we're on camera and on Zoom and we think, oh, this is a, listen, it's a better way of connecting than nothing. Don't get me wrong. But it is not the same information that we would get when we're in person with someone, when we are seeing all of the micro expressions that happen that are not being, you know, that are not performative, when we are seeing all of the, you know, when we hear the little sounds that we miss from a microphone because it doesn't pick up everything. So there's information missing first and foremost that helps us be more emotionally intelligent when we're in person. Mm. And there's the added bonus of, when we are working remotely, we have way more time to run our stories through our head, to run our way of thinking through our head, and to get stuck in what those are. Because we do not have people around us who we are seeing, even if, like, we don't always think about how much information we get just from being in the same office as other people and how that changes our perspective or ways of thinking. That doesn't, when you're working remotely, we don't have any of that. None of that information is coming to us. So the idea of emotional intelligence really just came from emotional intelligence is imperative to functioning as a human in the world, in my opinion. What does that look like in a remote world? Because it's different. We are communicating with emojis. You know, we are having this disconnected way of whether it's text or email, or performing on Zoom, or having a phone call. We do not have the in-between conversations when we're working or dealing in a remote world. If you think about from the time, I'm gonna use family as an example, I'll use my own family. The difference between me living at home with my mother and my parents, my father died before that, but me living at home with my mother and the information I got from her and the relationship we have and how we conversed and related to each other versus When I moved to Montreal and was not only in a different city, so seeing her much less often, but wasn't around her every day. If we think about that difference from family and how we relate, it's night and day because we are not in the same place. And it's just different. It's not better or worse. So emotional intelligence was really taking the ideas of emotional intelligence and saying, how do we apply these in a remote world? What does this look like in a remote world? And for me, the buck always stops with me. So what can I control? What is in my purview? What questions can I ask myself? What assumptions do I have to be questioning? What biases do I have to be questioning? What do I have to be aware of? How do I ask better questions so that I can manage myself and other people in this disconnected way better?
Yeah, there's a lot in that. I think one of the biggest things about working remotely is our assumptions are like 1,000-fold. 1,000 times.
Yep.
And it's, you know, people that will have listened to this podcast for a while will be very used to hearing this notion of John. One of John and I's mantras is test your assumptions, ask more questions, make fewer statements.
Yep.
But if this is something you're quite new to, And I you'd hope a lot of leaders would have heard of it before, but actually even for teammates to be more aware of it, how do you test your assumptions? How are you aware of your assumptions? How are you checking in with them? Because like you said, that space of being in your own narrative, and especially when you're on back-to-back Zooms, and then when you do have time out, what stories are running through your head? And nobody's there to just grab you and go, are you okay after that conversation? Or what did you think when you saw so-and-so say that in that meeting? There's none of that. So with that, Celine, what would be your kind of, you know, guide to a leader on how they can improve their emotional intelligence?
So I would say that there's two... and I'm going to say that I don't think this is only specific to emotional intelligence, but I think it stemmed from this, like the me thinking about it in this way. The first thing I would say is we need to set better expectations with people in a remote environment than we do in a day-to-day environment. And caveat, we need to set better expectations with people in general. I am not one of those people who thinks that setting expectations is a bad thing. I think it is basically setting ground rules. It is, here is the foundation of how this is going to work. In a remote environment, it is imperative for us to be emotionally intelligent that we have ground rules and we know what the expectations are. It doesn't mean, it can be as simple as, I'm going to go back to feedback for a second because I give this example a lot when talking about emotional intelligence. Hey, John, we're going to be working together. Can we talk about how you like to receive feedback and how I like to receive feedback so that as we're in this environment and we're not day to day, face to face, I can make sure that I'm giving you valuable feedback in a way that's going to work for you and vice versa, because we still want to grow and get this project done in a timely way. Having that, set that expectation, have that conversation with people is really key for emotional intelligence to work and for leaders to be aware of in a remote environment. And I will tell you, that did not happen this year. People just took whatever they were doing in the office and said, we're going to do this remotely. And it's going to be the exact same meetings, all the exact same structures, and it doesn't work. It is not the same thing. So as simple as let's set some expectations and have explicit conversations about these things is a game changer. And then I would say, and I'm just going to give you two really, really like simple, fast examples. That is one of them, setting those expectations. But the other thing I would say is when you were talking about asking better questions, that is, I cannot tell you the difference maker it is in terms of questioning our own assumptions to ask better questions. And I think the hardest shift that leaders can make in a lot of cases, not for everyone, but is to stop asking questions that are leading people to your assumption and start asking questions that are leading people away from your assumption on purpose. And the better we can get at asking questions that are not saying, hey, step into my assumption with me and prove me right, but rather tell me more about your perspective. Tell me about something that has nothing to do with my assumption and seeing where that goes, the better we are, the better information we get, and the better we are at working remotely with people in this disconnected environment.
For the benefit of everybody listening to this podcast, there's a lot of nodding and a lot of smiling going on this Zoom call. You know, that is so, I think that's so useful for people to listen to and to take on board, Celine. I really do, because this is not, like you say, I don't think we will ever go back to the way that we worked before. We will be in this hybrid space for the foreseeable future. What it was leading me to think about, you said something about when people are on one call after another, and you don't really get the opportunity to bump into somebody in the corridor of the office, or somebody doesn't distract you like they would do normally if you were just working in like an open office space. And what concerns me is that we've heard a lot of people this year talking about mental health and how you get through your day, how you motivate yourself. And what concerns me is that people living in this world and working in this world are constantly in their own head, and they're constantly having these conversations with themselves, and probably not to a positive outcome, more of a very introspective way of thinking. A, do you think that is the case? And if you do, what would you say was really useful for people to be able to help them?
So I think that's definitely the case. And, you know, I will own fully that I am a person who is, in a not pandemic year, wildly introspective. I am one of those people that it is both, I always joke, it's both a superpower and my greatest weakness. Like I had a therapist tell me once, and I've had a coach tell me this too, funny enough, that they are never going to say something that I haven't already thought about myself. Because I am like constantly in my introspecting on myself and my things and what I said, and not necessarily judging, but I am like running it through, and I'm thinking of all the things, and ooh, what's that thought pattern? What assumption am I making there? What was the, like, constantly. So I will fully own that I am one of those people that definitely got more introspective this year, I think, which is great.
It's a nightmare, isn't it? It is us.
Exhausting.
It's what we do. And you just sometimes, am I just thinking too much?
Totally. So, but I think it's important to acknowledge, like, yes, I am one of those people. I think there are a lot of people, I think people that are not even, don't even normally have that tendency this year, have gone to that place. And if you don't normally have that tendency, I think if you have many years of doing it, if you have training as a coach, you have healthy ways of moving through, healthier, not always healthy, healthier ways of moving through it so you don't get stuck in it. When you don't have that, I think it can have real mental health effects that people are dealing with this year, to what you were saying. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with introspection. I think there's a wonderful opportunity for growth if you allow yourself to move into the lesson and the next step of it, and not just get stuck in the introspection spiral part of it, which is what I see a lot of people doing this year, is getting into that spiral of introspection where you're not actually doing anything with it, and you're creating this vortex of speed and space and time and over again, and then you are running a thought pattern 1,000 times over in your head, and now you have that new neural network, so now that thought pattern is going 1,000 times more, as opposed to having the tools or skill set to recognize that that is happening and step out of it to do something productive with it. And that, to me, has been definitely something I have seen, even just friends of mine, let alone people I've worked with this year, really getting stuck in and really unsure of how to get out of. And I think there's, I mean, listen, if you do not have the funds to work with a therapist or a coach, you can journal to get out of it. Journaling is a really great space to get that out of your head and to start to see the patterns and to move through it. There are mental health apps now, right? Like in North America, we have BetterHelp, I think it's called. There's a Canadian one. I'm sure there's something in the UK if those aren't available, that is a great space to have a conversation with a therapist, whether it's video or text, to be able to get out of that patterns. If you're in an organization and you're a leader who's getting stuck with this, really see if you can find a coach, because getting it out of your head, getting it out of that thought pattern, that neural, that pathway that you are running back and forth, that track you've created in your brain, that is the key thing to moving it into the next step and moving it into what you can now do with it, what this can look like, where the growth is inside of it. There's nothing wrong with introspection. It shows us our growth edges. It's toxic and has mental health benefits or mental health detriments, pardon me, when you don't get out of just the introspecting part of it.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I think when we think about remote workers, because as you were talking earlier, I used to work remotely when I worked for British Airways. I worked with a team in India and South Africa, and I never had any training on working remotely. And actually, when you were speaking then, I was remembering these things. But actually, most people think, or an assumption that many of us may have, should I correct myself, might be that people are more introverted prefer remote working, when actually to do remote working well, you need a higher emotional level of intelligence.
Yes.
And to add on to that, you tend to also be more introspective because you have more time in your own narrative. And I think to pull this back into a systemic point of view, I think this is the biggest thing that organizations have underestimated, as taking the in the office modality of working and putting it into a remote working. Because, yes, you know, I had a role for 6 months of the pandemic and the meetings were the same, right? Yes. It was a 2-hour meeting and then it was a 2-hour meeting on Zoom. And even our management leadership cascades were an hour and a half. Now, I hadn't realized I had got into the introspection of, you know, and actually I'm thinking about it now, I'm thinking I was overly harsh on them because I was seeing them on screen for an hour and a half. If I'd have seen them in person for an hour and a half, I'd have probably only given that 30 minutes thought on my way home, like, oh, reflecting on it. But having seen them on screen for an hour and a half, I was critiquing them in my head all day. So something that they'd said that may have been slightly obtuse or obnoxious, not understanding other people's circumstances, by the time I finished the day, they were the biggest villain in the planet, you know.
And oh yeah.
And I'm kind of going, you know, how do we pull all this together? Because remote working is only going to continue, but you need this lens of emotional intelligence. The meetings have to be different. I'll get to my point in a bit, but I think what's really lovely is this notion of the team coaching actually has more of a place now. Because if you can have a facilitator, brilliant, somebody to facilitate this, but if you could do that with your team weekly or every other week, you are giving them that space to teach them the skills to take that introspection to the next level. So what could we all step out of this and stop, start, continue? Yeah, that's kind of where my head's going with this. And I hadn't really made that connection that leaders maybe need to think about the how they're doing meetings and the amount of time they're on screen, because the stories that will be going through their team's head are probably longer than if they were physically with them.
Absolutely.
They're my musings. What are your thoughts on that, Celine, to kind of round this up?
I mean, I totally agree. I have run more workshops, virtual workshops this year on the fact that, I'm not even kidding you, on meetings specifically, on the fact that we cannot take the meetings that we do in person and just transfer that day onto Zoom and hope that people are managing themselves, doing effective work, connecting the way that we want them to connect. Because to your point, you have way, you know, the... If I step out of a meeting and if I'm in back-to-back meetings in the office and I'm running from meeting to meeting in an office environment, I have a physical disconnect. I'm saying hi to people. I'm, hey, John, nice to see you, as I'm walking to my next meeting. There is a different connecting point and disconnecting point in doing that. When you transfer that all onto Zoom, when you transfer that all virtually, which is what everyone did this year, which was so frustrating to watch happen as someone who's been talking about remote work for years and how we can't do that. The fact that everyone did it, I was like, come on now, we know better than this. But it just, it exacerbated all of these things, and it exacerbated and really exemplified, and we really got to see examples of, oh, look at how emotionally intelligent or lacking in emotional intelligence we are when we try and do it in this way. And I think all your points are right. Like, we have to, working remotely means thinking of meetings differently. It means setting up things differently. It means setting expectations differently. It means a good amount of introspection and having the ability to see patterns and be aware. And leaders have a huge opportunity to change the way that they are working with their teams, the way that other people are working with their teams, the way that the conversations are going, so that at the end of 2021, we're not having this conversation the exact same way again, going, well, look at all those opportunities that we could have used to work more effectively remotely, change the conversations, change the dynamics.
I think that the best, when you were talking about the team coaching, I think, you know, you're totally right on this notion of first team, not to perhaps the extent that Lencioni talks about it, but if we can think in terms of the relationships with our first team are the most important relationships, you set up the team far more for success. But you think about how most people think about the strength of their working relationships, and it is on your direct line up. That is the one that you put the primary emphasis on, or the majority of people do. And yeah. I hope that the biggest takeout of perhaps this conversation and of this of 2020 is that that cannot be the place for 2021, because if remote working will pull you more that way, i.e. your leader will be the one that you have more time with the are you okay check-ins versus the team. My worry for what's happened with remote working is that the team meetings, should we say in inverted commas, have become Friday or Thursday night drinks on Zoom. And that is not the same. And that is not a good substitute for that. Really, what are the strengths of the relationship and what are the ways of working and how do you deal with conflict at a first team level with your peers versus your direct line manager? And I really hope that that's the thing that 2021 can be the thing that most leaders work on, that interconnectivity of their team versus it becoming more siloed.
So I want to add to that really quickly. I think that's right. I think the other thing that I have seen that worries me is that team meetings have become an information dump and 100% like, here's all of the information, tactical, see you later. So I think that groups have gone sort of one or the other. There's extremes happening, right? It is that Thursday or Friday night drinks on Zoom. That's the connection point. Or there is no connection point beyond, let me vomit all of the information of the past week on you. Okay, cool. See you later. Peace out. Neither one.
Celine, you're forgetting. Has anybody got any feedback on that?
Yes, correct. Right. Like, neither of these, it doesn't work. It's not like we're missing. There's so much nuance inside of this and so much opportunity that is being missed when either of those things are being done. And I think this is the opportunity for leaders to really be strategic with how they approach 2021. And let's assume that things are going to be in a hybrid model where people are going to be working remotely. And what can you do? How can you work with your team most effectively? How can you get the best results from yourself and your team in this hybrid environment while supporting them and allowing them to be their best selves? Because it's not just like, I'm not talking drive results home no matter what. I am talking, how do we allow people to thrive? How do we enable them to be their best and get their best results so they feel good? And it helps them and it helps the organization. That's the opportunity in my perspective.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And I think on that lovely end, we could wrap up. But what we ask our guests to do, Celine, is share their three leadership essentials as a way to wrap up. So you've talked about quite a lot of stuff, so maybe picking three might be difficult for you. But if you were to think about, you know, our primary audience is leaders, what are the three leadership essentials for 2021 in this kind of remote team environment, what would be your three leadership essentials above all else?
So I would say that this is one of my personal mantras, but I want to share. I want to share it because I think it's I think it is very applicable. And I would say that it is be committed. I'm going to say from my perspective, because I'm so used to saying it from I, but we can then apply it out. I'm more committed to my own growth than I am to my comfort. And I think when leaders can keep that in mind, that being committed to growth over comfort is where we really see change. I think that would be one of them. You know, I'm going to repeat what I said earlier, which is critical thinking should be uncomfortable. If you are a leader who is constantly hearing what you want to hear, that is bias. Critical thinking should not be reinforcing the same thing that is in your brain already, no matter what. So I would say that is another really key, and I think that's vital for remote working, and I think that's going to be vital for 2021. And if there are any political leaders who are listening to this, please get comfortable with this because, oh man. And then I think the last one I would say is, I just realized that I was going to say, you know, we have to start doing a better job of questioning our own assumptions, but I think I'm going to take it to more of the introspection. I think introspection is vital for leaders. I think leaders need to understand their own patterns and the way that they think and, you know, those neural networks that they're laying down in their brain. I think introspection is vital, and don't get stuck in introspection.
The nuance there. I love it. Thank you very much. So if anybody is listening in North America or Canada and really likes what they've heard from you, Celine, I know you offer free strategy sessions on your website. Do you want to... just give details on where people can hit you up for Revisionary?
Yeah, I'm 100%. You can find me. My website is revisionary.ca. You can also just email me. Celine@revisionary.ca is probably the easiest thing, or LinkedIn.
In the show notes. So if people can't scribe that down. Likewise, if anybody's listening in the UK and just wants to chat around this idea of facilitation in team meetings and how and it can be a more cost-effective way, really, of the coaching, doing it at team level, people can check us out at Scaffold Coaching as well, so we'll put our links in the show notes too. So thank you so much, Celine. I've loved it. Happy 2021 to you.
Thank you to you as well. Happy New Year. It's lovely chatting with both of you.
Thank you, Celine, and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for continuing to listen to our Building Better Leaders podcast. We really hope that you are enjoying listening to the conversations that we're having with our guests. So please don't forget to leave us a rating or even a review so that other people may find this kind of content. Next time around on our white label interviews, we will be talking with Kevin Urrutia, who has built up over 5 businesses in a very short period of time across very different sectors, from full service to e-commerce to his latest creation, which is Voy Media, a full service marketing agency, which is number one for Facebook ads. Kevin is very enthusiastic. He has lots of energy. He's always smiling, very positive, very people focused. Got such a strong work ethic. He has bags of enthusiasm, and his underlying values are undoubtedly curiosity and a desire to learn more. So please look out for our white label interviews when we will be talking with Kevin Urrutia, staying stateside, for the Building Better Leaders podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you've got a lot out of this. If you'd like to read up a bit more on any of the content that you've heard in today's podcast, be sure to check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com.